Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service, coming to you live from London with me, Sean Lay. A ceasefire is not an end, but a beginning, the start of a process with both sides sensitive to any deviation from the agreement. The US Special Envoy negotiating between Hezbollah and Israel, Amos Hochstein, who we'll hear from shortly, brokered the deal in conjunction with France, the former colonial power in Lebanon and still influential there. Mr. Hochstein stressed that the next 60 days should see a gradual withdrawal of Israel's defence forces from Lebanon's sovereign territory. Hezbollah, in turn, is supposed to remove its fighters and weapons from what's known as the Blue Line. That's the unofficial border between Lebanon and Israel and the Litani River, about 30 kilometres to the north of that. The Lebanese army will replace Hezbollah and ensure that any weapons or infrastructure used by the armed group can't be restored. Both Israel and Lebanon have cautioned people displaced by the fighting not to rush back to their homes, but thousands in southern Lebanon appeared to be ignoring that advice throughout the day on Wednesday. Lines of vehicles had backed up on the main highway that links Beirut, the capital, to southern Lebanon. Some drivers displayed Hezbollah flags and posters showing the group's former leader, Hassan Nasrallah, who was killed in an Israeli airstrike. And as we heard in the news, Israel has now imposed a nighttime curfew on those trying to travel into southern Lebanon. Well, the BBC's Lina Sinjab went to Dayya in southern Beirut today and spoke to one woman outside the ruins of her family home.
My name is Rayan Salman. I lived here for around 25 years since I was born. And we had to leave our home and we went to Aramun, Mount Lebanon, and it was so hard for us.
Can you explain what happened? Did you get a warning to leave, to evacuate?
Yes, we had a warning one night before and we left, but they just destroyed here before our house. So I came one night before and I saw my house. It wasn't destroyed, but it was a disaster. A night after, it's all gone.
And now what are you going to do? Who's going to bring that back to life?
We don't know. My parents spent all their life in this house and we did as well. And one night, all is gone.
Did you manage to take anything? Do you have anything from the house?
We didn't take anything from the house. We didn't have time.
We're glad you are safe as well.
We are safe, but we're not good.
Are you optimistic about this deal, that it will last?
I hope. We've been through a lot. And our generation, since we were graduated, corona, the dollar, everything, it's not right.
And now comes this.
And now comes this.
And what do you think is going to happen next, you know, with the country, with your own lives, with this, you know, destruction around?
We don't know.
Lina Sinjab there speaking to a woman displaced in southern Beirut. It's taken months of patient negotiation disrupted by long periods of impasse before this deal could be agreed. Both Israel and Hezbollah initially laid down conditions unacceptable to the other side, but then that's in the nature of negotiation. The question remains whether a deal with Hezbollah creates the space for a new initiative to bring an end to the fighting in Gaza, where Israel is in conflict with Hamas. I asked Amos Hochstein, US Special Envoy negotiating between Hezbollah and Israel, about that. But first, in this, one of his first interviews since he helped broker the ceasefire between Israel and Hezbollah, I asked him how he thinks the mistakes of a previous ceasefire agreement made in 2006 can be avoided.
That's a great question. It's the most important one, because the 2006 agreement was remarkably successful in ending the conflict and a total failure when it comes to actual implementation. I mean, first of all, the language itself was a document that was not a very likely one to succeed anyway, because it asked for things that were not very realistic.
Got you. So would you then endorse the position that was outlined to us yesterday by the former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert, who said it initially worked well when the UN peacekeepers concerned were from European countries, but when they were succeeded by troops from, and this is a direct quote from him, Fiji, Caribbean Islands, the Philippines, they thought it was a tourist venture, not a military mission. In other words, then there was an opportunity, a vacuum created, which Hezbollah was able to take advantage of.
Look, I get his point, but no, I actually don't agree with that. I think that the failure itself was there was no implementation mechanism. There was no monitoring. UNIFIL is unarmed peacekeepers. They don't get into a fight with Hezbollah. There was nobody there
How does this avoid that problem?
Let me answer it this way.
Yeah.
There were tunnels that were found in this war that were 1.5 kilometers long, large enough to hold thousands, not hundreds, but thousands of Hezbollah fighters with weapons that were within yards away, a few hundred meters away from UNIFIL positions. Something's got to give. That cannot continue. And we are going to be watching like hawks everything that is happening on the ground, because that is the key to all of this.
Right. Now, in terms of these practicalities, why stop now when Hezbollah, a group your own country designates as a foreign terrorist organization, is on its knees? Surely it's in both the United States' interest and Israel's to blunt an organization which is arguably part of the influence which Iran wields in the region.
You're 100% right, which is why once the Israelis were successful in eliminating Nasrallah and the leadership, we did not push for a ceasefire right away, even though others were, and we needed to play out a little bit. Well, we decided a few weeks ago, together with the Israelis and the Lebanese, that this was the right moment. And here's the deal. There's always another Hezbollah guy to kill. There's always more territory that you can take here and there, another village. But at some point, you have to translate your military gains on the battlefield into an arrangement. Because if you just keep going, you have your own casualties, your own destruction, and you don't get your goal. And the war goal here is not to eliminate Hezbollah. That's not what Israel ever said they wanted to do. Second, their goal was to bring their people back home in the north safely and securely. But Hezbollah was insisting on tying the fate of the Lebanese people to and give authority to Sinwar or to the Hamas over what happens in Lebanon by saying, we won't stop firing until the war in Gaza is over.
Yeah, so how did you get them to drop that demand?
Well, one is that was kind of the secret sauce of this agreement, is the delinkage of that. And the gains on the battlefield were very important to achieve that. And at the end of the day, look, both sides have to win something here. And I think the Lebanese people, by the time we did this agreement, a significant majority were like, enough is enough. We never asked for this war. Hezbollah went into it voluntarily. Israel didn't attack Lebanon. They attacked Israel. And we're kind of sick and tired of this. And the Lebanese people suddenly say, you know what? Hezbollah's weak,
so
militarily and politically. It's time for us to take back our country.
I just want to be clear what the two sides got of this. Are you saying then that you didn't offer Hezbollah anything to drop the demand that links us to the Gaza conflict?
No.
Right. And on the Israeli side, what persuaded Mr. Netanyahu to agree to a ceasefire, which he has been resisting for quite a long time? Did it have anything to do with extra offers or guarantees, which is reported by at least one television channel in Israel, that the United States made to the Israeli government?
I categorically deny all of these rumors that we threatened. I think one of them that I threatened that we would not veto Security Council resolutions.
You would have seen the pictures of people who have decided to try and go back to their homes. There's a big line of vehicles in the suburbs around southern Beirut. Lots of those people are flying the flag of Hezbollah. Lots of them are showing photographs of its dead former leader, Mr. Nasrallah. The hearts and minds side of this is surely an important aspect of any chance of a ceasefire holding, and any chance of Hezbollah, which after all knows the territory inside out, not simply rebuilding itself in this space that's been created.
Look, I saw the flags and so on. I always love when people who lose a battle, you know, it always reminds me of John Cleese when the knight loses his arm and he said, it's just a flesh wound. And after
Monty Python and the Holy Grail, I think you mean.
Yes, the Knights of the Holy Grail. And he says, like, I can still fight, you coward. So they're carrying a banner of Nasrallah. Let me just explain. They're carrying a banner of a guy who said that Israel would not be able to enter their land, and if they would never be able to capture anything, that their leadership was strong and all that. They crumbled. They literally crumbled. Hezbollah went to a war. They fought it. They lost it. But Nasrallah, the man that they're carrying his banner, is not going to save them. He's dead. His successor is dead. Most of the leadership are dead. And the Lebanese people, by a vast majority, want to see a new Lebanon with leaders that care about their own people. And at the end of the day, want to live their lives like normal human beings around the world with hopes, aspirations, and security and prosperity. That's what they want. The Israelis have zero territorial claims to Lebanon. This is not the West Bank. This is not Gaza. And we should stop doing Iran's job for them of tying conflicts to each other. They're unrelated.
Does this success in getting a ceasefire between Israel and Hezbollah offer any hope for a resolution of the conflict in Gaza, at least to the stage where the fighting stops?
Yeah, I think so. I think that where we are, interestingly, is that today, Hamas leadership wakes up this morning at 4 a.m. their time and says, the Israeli military, for the last 13 and a half months fighting us, has been distracted into a two-front war, and they now have only one front. That's a new reality that started today. Second reality is, for the last 13 and a half months, we had the largest terrorist organization on the planet was vowing never to stop unless we are taken care of. And all of a sudden, they cut a deal for themselves, and they cut Hamas out. So now Hamas is alone. And you know who supported this deal? Iran, the supporter of Hamas. So Iran betrayed Hamas here as well. They walked away and understood. So Hamas now, you guys are on your own. You're not in Doha anymore in fancy villas. So now you're on your own. And what President Biden said yesterday from the Rose Garden, these guys at Hamas have not come to the table negotiating in good faith for months. They have hostages, among them Americans, who are sitting in who knows what kind of horrific conditions for over a year. Come to the table, but you will not get a deal unless you release the hostages. And we are willing to pursue a deal. We think there's an opportunity now. So I think this deal yesterday opens two doors. One is for a deal with Hamas on getting the hostages out and ending the conflict. And two, if we get that done, a normalization agreement between Israel and Saudi Arabia. I know I sound crazy. But then again, people thought I sounded crazy when I said I thought I could get a deal in Lebanon. So it's okay. I read many articles how I was in fantasy land. But I believe that there's a moment opportunity. Will it happen? I don't know. But we have an opportunity. And I think that's why this deal is so important. It's not just about Lebanon. It's a key that unlocks potentially an even broader door.
Amos Hochstein. His official title is actually Deputy Assistant to the President and Senior Advisor for Energy and Investment at the White House. But he was talking to me there in his capacity as the US envoy who, along with the French, helped negotiate the ceasefire between Israel and Hezbollah. In a few minutes, we'll hear from Northern Israel reaction there to the ceasefire. You're listening to the BBC World Service. This is NewsHour. Coming up, we hear about the struggles of German car giant Volkswagen in China and its effect in Europe.
In 2019-2020, Tesla enters the scene. It kicked off this big electric vehicle push. And Volkswagen saw that consumers wanted these glitzy, high-tech vehicles, but it failed to produce the cars that consumers in China wanted.
That's coming up in 10 minutes. First, though, our headlines this hour. A spokeswoman for incoming US President Donald Trump says several people he's chosen have received threats, including bomb alerts. The Israeli military has imposed an overnight curfew on displaced Lebanese civilians returning to the south of the country after the ceasefire. And Ecuador's National Assembly has voted to impeach the former energy minister after she was blamed for the huge blackouts that have caused major disruption in the country. This is Sean Lay with NewsHour, live from the BBC in London. In northern Israel, there's apprehension about safety as around 60,000 Israelis are considering whether or not to return to their homes near the border following the ceasefire. The Israeli government spokesman David Mensah said Israel would adhere to the agreement, providing it was enforced.
We will respond forcefully to any violation. With the US's full understanding, Israel maintains full freedom of military action. So if Hezbollah violates the agreement and tries to again rearm itself, we will defend ourselves. If it tries to rebuild terrorist infrastructure near our border, we will defend ourselves. If it launches a rocket, if it digs a tunnel, if it brings in a truck carrying rockets, we will defend ourselves. Israel will respond forcefully to any violation.
That was David Mensah. Well, the BBC's Lucy Williamson has spent the day talking to people in northern Israel about what the ceasefire deal means for them.
The ceasefire today drew people back on both sides of the border. Maital and her 13-year-old daughter Geffen, back home in Kibbutz Manara for the first time in more than a year.
It's unbelievable. It's like a nightmare.
It's your first time back
in after a year. 1 year and 2 months. Yeah. We left on the 8th of, on October 23.
You've heard the small arms fire outside?
Yeah. They want to come back. So we need to...
Keep them away.
We're hearing regular bursts of small arms fire as we walk around the kibbutz here in Manara. Three quarters of the buildings here have been damaged or destroyed. People can't move back yet, but even if they could, they need to trust the ceasefire first. The Lebanese village of Mais al-Jabal, clearly visible across the border, is one of several places where Israel's army says it fired towards suspects spotted nearby. Not gun battles with Hezbollah fighters, it said, but warning shots. Four suspects were arrested.
I personally will come and be here regardless of whatever goes on there. But I'm a crazy, stubborn old lady, okay? Families will not come back here. No. It's impossible.
Orna Weinberg grew up in this kibbutz and has lived through Israel's two previous wars in Lebanon. Nothing will stop her from coming home, she says, but families may not return here.
They accumulated so much weapon and they dug so many tunnels. It would have been 1,000 times more than what happened in the south.
Do you trust the ceasefire?
I don't think the point is trust. This remains to be seen. But I know that it cannot be allowed to happen again. Our forces will not leave these villages and will not allow terrorists to come back here.
There are areas of this kibbutz where every house has had a direct hit with an anti-tank missile or a rocket, but it's only when you walk inside them that you get the scale of it. This was a house belonging to a family with two kids, and some kind of missile came straight through the wall here. The whole thing is blown out. The ceiling has come down. There's a thick layer of grey ash on the floor. The structure's crumbling. There's nothing left. The living room window looks out onto the Lebanese village next door. Everything here can change except the geography. Repairing this house will take months, but rebuilding a sense of security could take longer still.
Lucy Williamson on why doubts remain in northern Israel about the ceasefire negotiated between Hezbollah and Israel. 900 years of London's meat trade are to come to an end with the closure of Smithfield Market. The Corporation of the City of London, which governs the financial district, had planned to relocate both Smithfield and Billingsgate, the fish market, to a dockside location on the very eastern edge of London. Smithfield's history began with a livestock market in the 10th century. The market building itself was completed in 1868, and the centenary celebrations for that included a meat race as the porters competed with carcasses on their backs.
Smithfield, no gold medals here. They're more on the silver side for meat porters in the final heats of the carcass-carrying contest at the famous London Market. The athletics were part of the meat market centenary celebrations, held a month early so as not to conflict with the pre-Christmas trading rush.
Well, I asked Peter Twist, a tour guide, whether in the absence of that much excitement, what a visitor to Smithfield Market today might see, smell and hear.
Well, first of all, of course, they would have to come to it in the night. It starts trading at midnight. And it's a very busy market. So the whole city comes alive in the middle of the night. And whilst people are sleeping outside in the flats which surround the market, there's a huge amount of activity going on. There are lorries arriving from all over Europe, from all over Britain. They're bringing the carcasses of the meat, which are taken inside, and then the the people who are buying the meat walk up and down a thoroughfare called the Grand Avenue. It's quite a long one. It goes from one building to another, and they can inspect the products, which are on display on counters, compare prices, and then place their orders. So it's very, very animated, and it's also open to members of the public. So people in the know come along with a trolley, perhaps, so that they can buy plenty of meat for their week's food, and they're permitted to go in to make purchases just the same way as the people running the restaurants, the food shops, the bars, the pubs, the independent butchers. That's where they get their meat from.
Charles Dickens, the Victorian novelist, who was such an extraordinary accurate describer of the London of his day, called the market filthy and full of blood. But that's changed, hasn't it?
It did, because, of course, what he was describing was the last days of the open-air market. And that was absolutely filthy. And because the animals were brought there on the hoof and slaughtered nearby and then butchered, and the meat sold within that large open space called Smoothfield, hence the name Smithfield, the Victorians were absolutely appalled that there was such an activity taking place in the centre of the city of London. So they built this most beautiful building, built by Horace Jones, the city architect, who built also Leadenhall Market and Billingsgate Market, which was designed for the selling of fish. And the idea was that animals would be slaughtered in other parts of the area outside London. The carcasses would be then put onto trains, and trains would go on a special railway which was built to go underneath the market, and from there the meat would be brought up into the market.
We will still have the buildings, even after this decision. They're historic buildings, they're listed, they're protected. What do you think, in the last 30 seconds or so we have to us, what do you think we'll lose when Smithfield and Billingsgate close?
Well, we'll lose the atmosphere, we'll lose the opportunity for people to buy meat, and we'll lose the whole idea of a market, because all the traders will have to trade independently from their own premises. And the tradition of people going to Smithfield to buy meat and possibly to have breakfast afterwards, as the market was closing at 7 o'clock, will all be over, and the City of London will be very much the poorer in terms of its atmosphere for that. But the building, as you say, Sean, will survive, and it will be repurposed, and part of it will become the home of the Museum of London. So it'll continue to delight people, but there'll be nothing inside.
Tour while you can, and if you're lucky, you might even get Peter Twist to show you around. Welcome back to NewsHour. Volkswagen is to sell its factory in China's Xinjiang region. The factory, which opened 11 years ago in Urumqi, is controversial because it's in a region where the authorities have been accused of human rights violations. Campaigners say the Uyghur, a Muslim minority, are victimised through forced labour and detention camps. How far does the closure reflect international pressure, and how far commercial realities? That's a question I put to Jordan Dahl, automotive reporter with the news site Politico.
To be honest, it's probably neither. They have been facing a lot of pushback on their Xinjiang factory from investors, consumers, human rights groups. But the rumor was that they had to keep it open in order to appease Beijing and essentially be able to continue operating in the country. The fact that they are now deepening their partnership with SAIC and selling off the factory indicates that permission was given and that they are now off the hook. It stopped production in 2020, and now there are something like 200 people there that are doing quality checks for other models.
But what about Volkswagen's position in the country itself? Because it has been struggling, hasn't it? What's that down to?
It is struggling hugely. In 2019, 2020, Tesla enters the scene. It kicked off this big electric vehicle push. And Volkswagen saw that consumers wanted these glitzy, high-tech vehicles. And so it created CARIAD, its in-house software division, but it failed to produce the cars that consumers in China wanted.
Some of the commercial critics of the way China operates say that part of the problem is that you go in as an international company, and in order to be allowed to operate there, you effectively have to hand over your R&D. And that then makes you vulnerable to local competitors producing your product more cheaply and at a lower price.
True. But electric vehicles is a whole different kind of beast. And the reason that China has been so successful in that is because it's been home to tech companies and to tech manufacturing for several decades now. And so their prowess in batteries and EVs really came from them first producing all of our phones. And so, yes, there is some technology transfer, but it's perhaps more relevant in the tech sphere rather than just the automotive one.
More broadly, the company is facing problems at home, isn't it? I think it's facing possible union strike action because it's talking about closing factories, even in Germany. I mean, overall, is the automotive sector really struggling to adapt?
Absolutely. Volkswagen is in trouble all over the world. But it's not just Volkswagen. When you look at the broader European market, it's really every domestic automaker is struggling. It's a lot more expensive to produce a car in Europe. And so all of this is working against them, coupled with the fact that a lot of their technology does not match the Chinese when it comes to the software and when it comes to the batteries.
That's Jordan Dull, automotive reporter with news site Politico, talking to me about the trials and tribulations for the German motor manufacturer Volkswagen. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC. I'm Sean Lay. Well, back to our top story. Day one of the ceasefire between Israel and Hezbollah in Lebanon. Both sides have signalled their readiness to deal with any new attack. Israeli troops began a land invasion of Lebanon almost 2 months ago in response to almost a year of rocket attacks by Hezbollah into northern Israel. Hezbollah said its rocket attacks were in support of Palestinians in Gaza. Although much of the armed group's leadership has been killed and its organization is greatly weakened, Ibrahim al-Mazawi, a Hezbollah member of the Lebanese parliament, says Israel has not succeeded in its objective to destroy it.
We suffered losses, they're true, but I can tell you, you have to judge the results. The Israelis, when they started this war, they said that they want to crush Hezbollah, and they said equally they want to bring back the settlers into the occupied territories in northern Palestine by force. And they couldn't do it, but by indirect negotiations. So when you see the result, I believe this tells you something, doesn't it?
But how badly damaged is Hezbollah? Well, Paul Salem is the Vice President for International Engagement at the Middle East Institute.
Hezbollah lost almost all of its leadership, many of its fighters. It's lost control of the critical border area with Israel. Many of its weapons have been lost or destroyed. It is greatly degraded, but it still persists. It exists. It still has a lot of missiles and drones. It still has a fighting force. It's currently largely being commanded directly by Tehran since it did lose most of its leadership. So badly bruised, badly battered, but it continues. Most importantly, it has lost its ability to deter Israel, which was originally its function vis-a-vis Iran, and that has been lost.
Effectively, Iran is rendered more vulnerable as a result of what has happened to Hezbollah.
Yes, absolutely. Over the past many years, it was the case that Israelis as well as Americans, whenever they thought of any action potentially against Iran, their main concern was that Hezbollah could cause extensive damage in Israel, and that effectively appeared to deter Israel and the U.S. from escalating directly to Iran. That is no longer the case. Israel is no longer deterred, as is obvious. They've attacked Iran directly twice, and they might do so again.
The World Bank estimates that the war has cost over $8 billion in economic losses and physical damage to Lebanon. Lebanese will be entitled to ask, won't they, what they've got out of this. Hezbollah took them into this conflict with Israel, and it's not just Hezbollah that's paid the price for that. Ordinary Lebanese have paid a terrible price for it.
Absolutely, and those voices are very, very visible, very loud in Lebanon. It is a divided country and has been divided for a long time. The arguments have just gotten more acute. after Hezbollah effectively dragged Lebanon into another unnecessary war with Israel. It's not the first one. But so far, the party is claiming that this is yet another victory. I would say it's a Pyrrhic victory, but they claim it's another victory. Their supporters are, you know, beeping their horns as if it's some great victory. As you see in other countries, kind of brainwashing can go a long way.
Hezbollah in the past has increased its influence by money. In other words, it's funded a lot of the social welfare and the infrastructure needs of Lebanese people. And through that has been able to exercise political influence. Presumably, it doesn't have the money now to do that. Will that undermine its political credibility?
Yes, I think you you bring up a very, very critical point. The level of devastation in the areas of their own supporters in the south, in the southern suburbs of Lebanon, in the northern Bekaa Valley, as you said, are estimated in the billions of dollars. Iran will not have the means to offer and to rebuild, nor will the U.S. and the international community allow that to happen. And for the international community and perhaps the Arab countries to offer that kind of support, they will require many, many assurances from Lebanon, and they're certainly not going to do it in a way that would rebound to the political interests of Hezbollah. Hezbollah is also being more squeezed around the borders and the port and the airport, where the army with international support is being tasked to sort of control those, you know, in and out areas of the country. So yes, that will be a major challenge for the movement, and its people will not have those incomes and resources that they were used to having. How that will play out in politics, will that affect the positions of Hezbollah itself, or will some other group emerge? It's way too early to tell.
As you and I are speaking, Reuters news agency is just reporting the first statement made by Hezbollah's operations center since the ceasefire deal was announced. And in it, Hezbollah says it will continue resistance and stand alongside Palestinian fighters. Presumably it would say that, wouldn't it? It doesn't necessarily amount to very much.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what that would mean other than empty verbiage. It's the case that Hezbollah has withdrawn from the battle. It has left Hamas on its own. Hezbollah was the main ally that was supporting Hamas. Yes, the Houthis lobbed a few missiles occasionally, but it was really Hezbollah. And for Iran to have made the decision to take Hezbollah off the battlefield effectively leaves Hamas to its fate, which will not be, you know, already it's a bad one, but, they will have difficult decisions to make between Iraq and many hard places. I think there in Gaza, it's really up to Prime Minister Netanyahu how he will try to seek an end to the war in Gaza. Will he seek an end to the war in Gaza? Will he heed Trump's warning when Trump said, I'm with you in your wars, but wrap them up before I take office in January?
That's Paul Salem at the Middle East Institute. Israel is to appeal the arrest warrants against Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and the former defence minister issued by the International Criminal Court, the ICC. It raises a contested point of international law. To what extent, if any, are legal moves by the ICC enforceable in countries that are not signatories to the statute which established the court? That's also a question mooted by France's foreign minister when he was asked whether France would enforce the warrant against Mr Netanyahu. Jean-Noël Barrot suggested leaders of countries that are not members of the ICC enjoy certain immunities.
France will apply international law, which is based on its obligations to cooperate with the International Criminal Court and its obligations concerning the Rome Statute, which provides for and deals with issues of immunity for certain leaders. In any case, it is ultimately up to the judicial authorities to decide.
Well, Philippe Sans is a lawyer. He's a barrister in the UK and an advocate in France. So what does he make of the French foreign minister's statement?
It's a classic French position. They've always worried about head of state immunity under international law. And one of the reasons is because they feel so exposed themselves in relation to things that have happened in Africa now or Rwanda in the past. The position is really clear. As a matter of the law of the International Criminal Court, that court has ruled that a head of state has no immunity, even if they are the head of state of a third country. But that view and that ruling by the ICC a few years back is contested by many countries, including France, including, I suspect, also the United Kingdom. So it didn't come as a surprise, but it sets up a battle royal ahead.
And how would such a battle, if it were to arise, be resolved? I mean, the foreign minister, Mr. Barrot, was suggesting it would be resolved by the French judiciary.
Well, that's exactly the point. Does it get resolved by the International Criminal Court, in which case it gets resolved with no immunity entitlement for Mr. Netanyahu or Mr. Putin, who's in exactly the same position? But if it would go to the French courts would, I'm sure, follow what they consider to be French law's application of the international rules, which would, I suspect, be consistent with the rulings of the determinations by the Quai d'Orsay, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. This issue of immunity, of course, you've got to put in a much longer and bigger historical context. The most famous case, of course, is Senator Pinochet when he was arrested in London in 1998, and he was a former head of state. And there, the House of Lords ruled that a former head of state has no claim to immunity under national law, English law, but probably also international law. And that would be the situation if Mr. Netanyahu left office. But they did make it clear that for a serving head of state, the position then in English law in 1998 would have been an entitlement to immunity.
An extra quibble here. Is there a distinction drawn between whether one is a head of state, like a president, for example, or a head of government, which you could argue is what Mr. Netanyahu is right now?
It's a really important point. No, the head of state immunity doctrine will apply basically to a troika of characters. It's the head of state, it's the head of government, it's the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. And it may also be actually for the Minister of Defence would be governed also. But Mr. Gallant, for example, who is a former head of state, as a former Minister of Defence.
Minister of Defence, yes. So under this interpretation, his immunity would cease.
Has ceased when
Mr. Netanyahu sacked him. The other question about Mr. Netanyahu is that there are reports that he himself is considering an appeal to the ICC against the arrest warrant served against him and Mr. Gallant. Would the ICC entertain such an appeal? Would it, in legal terms, see him having locus, given that his country is not actually a signatory of the statute that established the ICC?
In general, the issue, I think, is so central and significant that the International Criminal Court itself will, I suspect, want to find ways to make sure that the issue is fully tested before any arrest warrant is actually enforced. It's also important to say that this is all slightly hypothetical in the sense that until Mr. Netanyahu actually sets foot in a member state of the International Criminal Court, the issue isn't going to arise in a practical sense. The court has no power to enforce an arrest warrant in Israel or in a third-party country.
It does raise the question of how much credibility the court still has, given these apparent attitudes, even of countries who have chosen to be members of the ICC.
It does indeed, and it raises the question of whether this is a stretch too far. Of course, the case of Mr. Netanyahu is not alone. The court has done exactly the same thing in relation to Mr. Putin. Russia is not a party to the statute of the International Criminal Court. There is an arrest warrant from the ICC in relation to the head of state of Russia, Vladimir Putin, and exactly the same issues arise. I mean, you've got here a classic battle between, on the one hand, the formalities of the law, what the law technically requires on the one hand, and on the other hand, political realities. And what we're witnessing is a confrontation between the world of law and the world of politics.
The lawyer Philippe Sands, and just to confirm that Israel has now decided to appeal those warrants. You're listening to the BBC World Service. This is NewsHour. This is Sean Lay with NewsHour, live from the BBC studios in London. Now, Alaa Abdel Fattah is Egypt's best-known political prisoner. A blogger and outspoken pro-democracy activist, he's been in prison for most of the past decade. In 2019, after 2 years in detention, he was convicted of spreading false news for sharing a Facebook page about torture in Egypt. His five-year sentence should have ended in September, but the Egyptian authorities refused to count the period he spent in custody before his trial. That decision prompted his mother, who was born in Britain, to go on hunger strike. She hasn't eaten now for 58 days. Today, Wednesday, Leyla Souif met the British Foreign Secretary David Lammy to discuss the case of her son Alaa, who has joint British-Egyptian citizenship. When NewsHour's James Melendez asked Leyla Souif how the meeting had gone.
It was a bit better than I expected. I mean, I was very sceptical. But Mr. Lammy is now starting to listen to us. I hope we'll get some action soon, because after all, my body has given us a lucky break by being resilient for so long, but we are running out of time.
Did he give you any specific assurances about what action the British government is taking or will take to try to secure Alaa's release?
Not quite. He did give us assurances about his commitment to the case, but we still have to see more positive, concrete action.
And what exactly would you like the British government to do?
Well, we have a number of asks. We have asked him to make the potential UK-Egypt trade summit, which the Prime Minister of Egypt is very keen to have, conditional on Alaa's release. As I pointed out, we're not asking great things because Alaa has actually finished his sentence. I mean, it's not like we're asking for him to be released before time or anything. So really, it should be doable.
The UK has no consular access to Alaa at the moment, despite him holding a British passport. I mean, is there any progress on that, for example?
We haven't been told that there is progress, but we're hoping to see progress on that. I asked Mr. Lammy specifically to do something about that. Hoping is maybe too strong a word. I wish to see progress on that during the coming days or weeks or something.
And the fact that Britain doesn't have consular access, does that mean it's been almost impossible to find out how Alaa is at the moment?
No, not quite, because we have access to Alaa as a family, but it just means that if there's something bad going on, the Egyptian government can just deny it and claim that we're lying.
Right. So how is he? How is he at the moment?
He's pretty dire. The last time I saw him was on the 18th of November, which was actually his 43rd birthday. So he was pretty down. He was very clear about not wanting to celebrate yet another birthday in jail. Anything, he didn't feel like he was ever going to be let out. I'm seeing him again next Saturday. I'm flying back to Egypt on Friday because his regular monthly visit is on Saturday. I hope to be able to make him a little bit less down, partly because of my meeting with Mr. Lammy and how frank and direct it was, but mainly because of all the media attention and all the support I got from British MPs and so on.
And also, how are you? How are you holding up?
I'm still holding up. I'm still functioning semi-normally. It's the phase where your body burns up extra fat. That's a phase in hunger strikes, which can be quite long. As I said, we're all having, me and Mr. Lammy and even the Egyptian authorities are all having a lucky break that I'm holding up so long, but we really should get on with this before I collapse. Personally, I don't want to collapse. And they're going to have a very embarrassing situation on their hands if I do collapse. And it would then be probably irreversible.
Indeed. I mean, what does Alaa think about what you're doing?
He accepts it. He knows me. He knows I don't change my mind when I set my mind in a certain direction. So basically, he accepts it because he knows me.
But, I mean, presumably he wouldn't want you to die trying to push his case before the British government, would he?
No, he wouldn't want me to die. He's very worried about me. But, you know, we both know the Egyptian regime. We know that this regime always expects one to back it down, and that if you back it down, they sort of run all over you. So he wouldn't want that happening to me either. He wouldn't want my, well, I suppose it's a bit theatrical saying this, but he wouldn't want my spirit to be broken.
No, I'm sure. I mean, do you hold on to the hope that you will live to see your son freed?
I have to hold on to that hope. I keep telling myself that, yes, it will happen. And, well, I suppose if it doesn't happen, I've gambled wrong and I won't be around to worry about it.
Why do you think the Egyptians are so determined to keep your son in jail? I mean, it's been, what, almost 10 years in total, hasn't it?
Partly because it is Alaa who is so prominent and so on, but also because they don't want to let anyone out. I mean, I've got a friend who is a university professor. He was a leading Muslim Brotherhood person, but he was a very good university professor, and he was very liberal for a Muslim. He was very liberal, actually, by any measures, and he was found innocent since 2018, and he's still in jail. If they can get away with it, they don't want to let anyone out.
And so why do you think they will possibly back down over Alaa's case and look at what you're doing and say, okay, well, this has gone too far? Why do you think they would do that?
Mainly if the British ask them to do it firmly enough, because they don't really want to upset the apple cart with the British. I mean, they need the British and they need their alignment with the West. And also because my present hunger strike is generating a lot of sympathy in Egypt, and it's, you know, putting indirect pressure, maybe, but it is putting pressure on them.
So you do strongly believe that Britain does have leverage over Egypt, and if it absolutely exerts that leverage, it will work.
Absolutely, absolutely, absolutely.
James Menendez was talking to Leyla Souif, herself a distinguished mathematician. Now in the 58th day of the hunger strike, she hopes will help free her son, Alaa Abd El Fattah, from an Egyptian jail. This is Sean Lay thanking you so much for your company here on NewsHour. Do come visit us again.